This is For Advisors by Advisors. I'm your host, Evan J. Mayer. And today we have a very special guest and Mr. Chris Florer. You were waiting for the applause.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I've been on vacation. It's been a couple weeks since I've done one of these. But so anyway, sorry for the shortness there. Chris is a trust consultant with Raymond James Trust Company, part of Raymond James Financial Services. Been with the firm since 2018 in that role, though you were here for a little bit as an advisor as well. We'll break down a little bit of that with you. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Evan.
Absolutely. So this is our first time having somebody from Trust Services on the show. And I think the interesting thing is that it's always good to know what you guys are doing and you're up to and what you can offer advisors, what you can offer advisors, family and friends. And it's not just Raymond James. A lot of the firms offer. And am I wrong to say that LPL and...
LPL has Trust Services as well through their affiliate. Across the industry, actually, there'll be a lot of providers. Some firms choose to use a bank model and other firms choose to use an independent, especially for independent advisors, choose to go the independent trustee route a lot of times.
Yeah, excellent. So anyway, Chris is with Raymond James, has been with Raymond James since 2018. Tell us a little bit about your history in the business. The interesting way I kind of know you is I kind of know your dad, but not really. I've met your dad a few times and I know him. He knows of me. But he had left SunTrust pretty much, I think, the year prior to me joining or something along those lines. And he was known in our territory. I didn't know about you until I joined Raymond James. And then they're like, oh, well, Chris Florer, senior or junior? And I said, well, there is no senior or junior, just Chris Florer. So which one is which? So your dad is Chris Florer, senior.
Correct.
Yes. And we were just talking. I thought that was interesting when you got your law degree. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started in law after attending Florida State Law, graduated there and actually moved to Pensacola. And I was just the youngest person around as far as an attorney goes. And I did everything I could to kind of get rid of that stigma as much as I could. So changed the haircut, started wearing glasses instead of contacts, dropped the junior. So that's really the origin of it. And then turns out we end up working together at the same firm a few years later. So it caused a little bit of a complication.
So talk about that a little bit. A lot of times we see, and your dad happens to be a very successful financial advisor. Most successful financial advisors, their kids eventually come into the business. We see a lot of that. You came into the business, but you didn't necessarily come in directly. You came in indirectly and then kind of met up with dad later when you were already here and he joined. So tell us a little bit about that history. Like, did you ever decide that you wanted to work with dad and become a financial advisor? How did you go from law school to finance?
Yeah, I ended up in law school for kind of an untraditional reason. The market collapsed in 08, 09 when I was going to be graduating. I had an LSAT score sitting out there. I went to law school. So I realized always that I was going to do something more financial, but coming out of law school, that was the best option for me. I understood estate planning very well, being from my father's experience and learning from him. And then after getting out of law and moving back to South Florida, it really made a lot of sense, synergies there. And I joined his practice when he went independent and actually left Wells Fargo. So that's where he was at.
When did he leave Wells and go independent?
That was 2009, I believe.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And he was with SunTrust prior to then, right?
SunTrust prior to Wells.
Yeah. And so
actually, that was 2014. Yeah, I confused those dates. It was 2014. That's when he went independent.
Got it. Yeah. So you're working with him on the independent side. That's your first entry into finance.
Yeah, did my 766, started working with clients, got my 9 and 10 yep. as well, actually. And I just kind of felt that it was time for me to do something on my own. I didn't feel that I was bringing enough on the relationship development, new asset side. I was 27 years old, and it can be hard to get clients at that age. And yep. so I was really servicing clients and helping them with their estate planning and those needs, but not, I didn't think bringing a lot to the table on the asset generation side.
You weren't making it rain.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And I knew some individuals from the trust company from working with him, and this opportunity opened up at the trust company. It was really a great fit for me.
So did you leave right from being a financial advisor right into the trust?
No, actually, I took a job in tech. I was recruited to a job in tech selling to financial services companies, and it just wasn't a good fit. I can't talk tech. It's not. First podcast I've ever joined. You know, I'm not necessarily a techie guy.
Yeah,
it just didn't match up. I'm much more conversant in legal matters.
Yeah. Yeah, and so the trust opportunity opened up at Ray J. You already kind of connected into Ray J.
Yeah, and so I knew I was going to end that tech thing pretty yep. much 8 months in. And so I started reaching out to some people. My licenses, of course, were still, you know, valid. At the time, it was 2 years. Now it's five. I was able to get back in the industry without having to retest for anything.
Very cool. So tell us a little bit about the dynamic in the bank channel, which is where I came from, was mm-hmm. trust was our enemy. And they were our enemy, not into the concept of what they could do for clients, because in that concept, they were a great ally. And I partnered with trust a lot of times, but there was also an asset situation where if a client or prospect had a certain amount of assets, that those assets would get directed to trust and trust advisors and not to financial advisors. And there was an obvious reason on the bank side to do that is they wanted to retain those assets and keep those as bank clients. So as new advisors come from the bank channel or even come from the wirehouse channel and join the independent channel with Raymond James, do you initially get any kind of pushback like, oh, trust services, it's interesting, you guys do great stuff, but you were kind of our enemy at the last location. Do you ever get a little bit of that?
I have that conversation constantly. Really, that's one of the big things I do when an independent advisor joins is let them know that we're not the enemy, that all of the assets stay, you know, with you and you remain the advisor. We don't have a model that, you know, at a certain threshold takes away advisor assets or automatically becomes a bank and trust client, because the way we work is we only work with Raymond James affiliated advisors, and they're not our clients, they're your clients. So that's really one of my main points when I meet new advisors that are independent, is educating on them that we can do these things without jeopardizing your relationship like it might have been done at your prior firm.
Yeah, very interesting. It's a different concept because I've now been here almost 5 years. And when we need you, you're there. And when we don't need you, you're not bothering us per se, which is a nice thing, because back then it was almost like there's a piece of bread and who's going to get the bread, the hawk or the...
Absolutely. You have the trust company or the private bank looking over your book and seeing, oh, this might be a prospect for us. I've actually brought on new trust relationships. I'm thinking about one from SunTrust right now that the advisor came over and said, hey, we're going to bring this relationship now. We never brought it because this would have made it cross the $5 million threshold. And now we can bring the outside trust that there's a special needs beneficiary over, now that we won't cross that barrier and it become a private bank client.
Yeah, very interesting. And what I also think is somewhat neat is that you're there as a trust company to help, but we're not also required to use you. And the concept that if there's other trust companies out there that are a good fit, or you're not able to handle that client in a good situation, we can use outside trust companies, which is a little unique too.
Very unique. And I'd say we're oftentimes the best solution. We're in-house and our systems work together with everything. And we have some unique advantages here at Raymond James, especially in the special needs area. That's an area we're very focused on.
So tell us a little bit about that. You would say that's one of the specialty outside, if you had to compare yourself to other trusts.
Absolutely. So in the marketplace right now for corporate trustees, you'll see a lot of corporate trustees, especially larger, non-specialized corporate trustees, getting out of the special needs business. I mean, it's time intensive. You have to stay up on SSI and Medicaid requirements for all of the 50 states if you're administering on all of the 50 states like we are. So unless you have the volume of clients, it doesn't necessarily make sense from a risk and time perspective. We here at Raymond James Trust, we manage $1.5 billion approximately in special needs assets. So it's a part of the business that we're dedicated to. And we have a director of special needs and an entire special needs team. So we've really stepped into that marketplace as there's been a little bit of a vacancy.
So talk to me a little bit about, I have clients that have named Raymond James as a successor trustee upon their passing. Mm-hmm. And it might be in a state that stays, it might be in a state that doesn't stay. How does that whole situation unfold? The client passes away, death certificate's provided. What does the advisor do from there? What's the relationship look like going forward for not only the advisor, but for trust services and the client's estate?
One of the things we do at Raymond James is make sure that the advisor is always involved. So they're going to be the front person, the point of contact always for the client, and they can decide how little or how much we directly interact with the client. Sometimes you have sticky relationships that everything you want to be filtered through the advisor. So we always go through that method. Now, of course, there are times we need to talk directly with the client and get things in writing, but we will always incorporate the advisor in those communications. Oftentimes how it starts is an advisor calls me and says, hey, Chris, I had a client that passed away. You guys have been named. and I get the client name. We go from there, gather the necessary information that we need to do. The client, the advisor stays involved in the process, and then we make a distribution of the assets as it states in the trust agreement. A lot of times, if a corporate trustee is involved, whether it's Raymond James Trust or not, the reason they're using a corporate trustee is that they're setting up resulting trusts for their children or heirs, whoever it might be, to be administered in the future. So at that point, when those trusts are funded, we're of course communicating with the advisor as well on how we're going to invest these assets that are funding the resulting trust for the children.
Excellent. Excellent. And you keep the advisor actively involved.
Yeah, always.
And that's a great thing.
Well, the advisor is our client.
Yep.
We don't do business without the advisor, and they're our client more than sometimes the actual end client is, because we don't do business without you.
Now, hypothetically speaking, so pretty much everybody that is named through Raymond James Trust was referred by an advisor. Would you say it's like 99.9% that case?
99.9%. Sometimes actually in the special needs area, it happens a little bit more, is that attorneys that work with us know that we operate in that area. And so that client might not have a Raymond James advisor already, but they know that we can handle the special needs aspect of it. And so I might get referrals from attorneys that way, and then suggest the number of advisors they might want to talk to.
Cool. So actually, you don't even have advisors on staff per se. You can bring in outside advisors.
We don't have advisors on staff. I do not gather outside assets. That's not a mandate of my job. It's only through advisors.
Very neat. And which is why I found that this has not only been a good home for me, it was the capability that you guys are there when we need you. And that's always excellent. What has changed in trusts and estates and in estate planning in the last 3 to 5 years that has anything changed that has dramatically shifted the landscape from what you do on a day in, day out basis or the back office does on a day in and day out basis?
Also, on a planning side, we're seeing, of course, a lot of activity with the expiration of the Tax and Job Cuts Act that's coming up in the end of 2025. So that was implemented in 2017. You did see some activity there among the ultra high net worth community gifting assets. So that's driven a lot of estate planning strategy right now. Now, from the corporate trustee marketplace, you are seeing a lot of aggregation. BB&T and SunTrust is one that I think of. We picked up a lot of business at Raymond James Trust as a result of clients being unhappy with that merger, losing their contact person, so to speak. So we have really, our model is different in that we provide, the advisor is always going to be the main point of contact, and we provide an additional level of contact. And what you've seen with the aggregation is that a lot of people are losing their dedicated point of contact that they've had for years. And now they might be open to moving those trusts to a different institution.
Are you seeing that evolve with Citi as an example? Citi lost like 20,000, laid off 20,000 people. Are you seeing any kind of migration there from trust services?
I haven't seen any personally yet. Now, it's really kind of a slow process, right? And people have to get frustrated enough that they've had that much turnover. But that's usually when we get a call from the advisor, or that's a new prospect for us, is that it's not someone naming us in the future to serve a successor, but it's a trust already established, and they want to move, the advisor wants to move that to Raymond James Trust under their management.
Yep.
So those kind of.
So the mergers actually cause more friction than layoffs per se, because at least with the layoffs, they still know they're working with that same bank. Mm-hmm. But when there's a merger situation, they might have to rename the corporate trustee.
Not even renaming, it's just the shuffling of trust officers. One of the things that I see with clients is just the never-ending rotation. It's not uncommon for me to get a call and the client say, hey, I've had 4 trust officers in the past 2 years. I don't even know who to call anymore. I call them, I have to explain myself again.
And you're basically the guy down here in Florida, in South Florida, for Raymond James. You're
not the trust officer, but the trust consultant. So I'm on the new business side.
Yep.
We have a team of 150 people behind me that actually administer the accounts.
Got it.
On a day in, day out basis.
Got it. Very cool. Is there any difference on how you guys act with the wirehouse side, the Raymond James and Associates side, compared to the Raymond James Financial side?
There's actually not. So people think that there might be a difference, but I'm the same person for all channels, and we treat all channels equally. So you're not getting any special treatment as far as that goes if you're in the, you know, the company employee channel versus the independent channel.
Got it. It's the same thing.
Yep.
Very neat. Very cool. Any legal strategies? You mentioned this, the tax cut situation changing, the estate limits or state tax limits are going to be changing within a year. It doesn't look like there's any new legislation or anything in the works. What are you guys doing to prep clients for that?
We're just knowledge, really. And it's prepping advisors more so than clients,
right? Yeah.
Just to make sure that they're aware and understand how it operates so that clients can take advantage of those additional gifts now, if it makes sense for their estate plan. Now, you'd have to have significant assets for it to make sense. So it's your larger clients that you're thinking about, those 35 plus million dollar clients who can take advantage of that kind of gifting from that standpoint. But just a lot of needs-based planning too. More clients have more and more asset protection concerns, whether it be divorce, whether it be high-risk professions, or just making sure that these are going to assets are going to last. That's always the core of our business.
Yeah.
The tax planning does drive some of it, but that's not always the corporate trustee side.
Yeah.
So we're trying to educate advisors and let them know they can use us for these services as well. But the core of our business is always going to be driven by client need.
Talk a little bit about individual trustees versus naming corporate trustees. A lot of people like to name their lawyer or their friend who's an accountant or somebody like that as their trustee. There's obviously pitfalls. You can see the show American Greed on CNBC. You can see theft and all that kind of stuff. Can you talk about the pros and cons of each?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So individual trustees are not always a bad solution. I wouldn't be negative on them in all circumstances. Now, of course, it has to be somebody that you do have a good relationship with and that you do trust, because they do have those situations of American greed and theft and things along those lines. But for considering all the client's assets is very important from that perspective, because a corporate trustee has certain legal requirements that they have to, and fiduciary duties that they have to operate within. And sometimes those can be limiting, especially for a family, for example, that might have large real estate wealth, a concentration of 80 to 90% in real estate, multifamily, commercial, whatever it might be. That necessarily might not be the best solution for a corporate trustee. Or if you want to actively invest in real estate, that's not the best solution, because we have to go through our approval processes. And not that it can't be done, but it's not time efficient the way you're chasing deals.
Yeah. Yeah. Pros though, on your side, like, why, if I'm considering I'm 50-50 between a friend of mine versus hiring a corporate trustee, why am I going corporate trustee?
Well, you're going corporate trustee, one, because your friend doesn't want to do all of this stuff that's required. I mean, you're putting him in a pretty precarious position. Not only does he have to be responsible for the distributions to your heirs, but also the oversight of management, administration, providing notice to the beneficiary. So there's a lot of legal duties that clients don't necessarily think about when they're naming a trustee. So we actually take over from individuals in certain circumstances when they've been named and said, hey, I didn't really want to do all of this. So there's a legal exposure as far as it, and also a time commitment that's required. Does this person have the expertise and time and knowledge? If they're going to an attorney and a CPA for everything anyway, it may make more sense to just use a corporate and then take them out of the picture from that standpoint.
It also removes conflicts of interest, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. Independent third party, we're not going to have conflicts of interest, and we're going to be better from an asset protection standpoint than naming a beneficiary themselves, and of course.
Now, some people have concerns that using a corporate trustee might make the corporate trustee take longer, meaning they're collecting more fees by holding on to the assets. Let's just say a client passes away, they have three or four beneficiaries, they named you as Raymond James as corporate trustee to handle the distribution of the estate. How long is the normal estate process take on your end?
As far as, you know, estate settlement goes?
Yep.
So estate settlement varies based on the complexity. One of the things right now, settlement will take 9 to 12 months in a non-taxable estate. Now, if you're in a taxable estate, it's very difficult right now to get closing letters from the IRS. Those are typically taking 2 years about that. And regard to the increased complexity and also just the timeliness of the IRS.
So people should anticipate that if a client passes, or an advisor should consider if a client passes, their estate is not necessarily going to be liquidated to the heirs 3 to 6 months. It's normally a 6 month to 2 year kind of process.
It all dependent on assets. And like I said, non-taxable situations much easier than a taxable estate from that standpoint. And then also complexity. If you have a number of properties that must be sold, if the properties are redistributing outright. So all of those things, the language of the trust dictates what the time frame is. Now, 3 months Anybody that says that to you, I'd say that's rather aggressive, because we have a statutory creditor period here in Florida of 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
As far as the future goes for you, you've been on both sides now. You've been on the advisor side. You're on the trust side. I'm guessing you're happy doing the trust side. Is there thoughts to the future to becoming an advisor again?
Yeah, always thoughts as to that. Right now, I like where I'm at. I get to really have the advantage of seeing how 800 advisors run their book. And I get to talk to their biggest clients oftentimes. So I'm talking to a different type of interesting person every day. So that it does work out really well for me right now. I enjoy what I'm doing. And it's also good to help advisors. And you could see them growing their book. But at a time, there might be in the future that I want to grow my own book. But for right now, it's a good mix for me. And no day is ever the same.
And how would you, what advice would you give to younger advisors that are looking to leverage trust services? What are some good ways to get new business by leveraging trust services?
So I would say always attorney contacts. Well, now, everybody always thinks about estate planning attorneys, right? Another thing to think about is litigation, tort litigation attorneys, or estate or probate litigation attorneys that do trust litigation as well. So those estate litigation and trust litigation attorneys, they already have existing problems with a trustee. That's most cases why they're involved.
Yep.
So they need somewhere else to go once they resolve that problem. So that's one area to look at that's commonly overlooked. And then personal injury. So that's where we do a large amount of our special needs business, is from personal injury attorneys or mass tort attorneys who have causes an injury and leads to a special needs situation. So there's some advisors that do a large amount of business with us because of those relationships.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Some attorneys recommend that beneficiaries be named individually, and some suggest the trust gets named and the assets then get distributed through an IRA through the trust. What's the difference? Is there any negative to doing it one way versus the other way? And if you were the estate attorney, would you recommend one way or versus the other?
So the situation is going to dictate what's the best solution. Now, IRAs and trusts, the rules were all changed by the SECURE Act. So before, it was very common suggestion and kind of a no-brainer at times to say, hey, let's make this go through the trust because we can extend it beyond the five-year period to look through to the life expectancy of the beneficiary. The SECURE Act did away with that. So now trusts are going to be at 5 years, provided that there's an identified beneficiary in the trust. So a conduit trust, and now there's two different ways to look at it. A conduit, which goes right through the trust and passes out, or an accumulation trust in which, and that's probably what you're referring to, in which the assets are accumulated in the trust and distributed upon the same terms as the rest of the trust agreement?
Actually, more along the lines of, I've seen individual state attorneys recommend that we put our clients, beneficiaries, and individual names and just open up IRAs upon the client passing. Mm-hmm. It's an easier distribution to the client and it doesn't have to go through the trust and estate closing process. And then I've had other attorneys that recommended naming the trust as the beneficiary so that it can, I guess, then do conduit IRAs to those individuals. And I didn't know if there was a net benefit to doing it one way versus the other.
So that, from that standpoint, you're using a conduit and the rules are going to be the same. It's just a matter of, do they want to have it go to their trust and split it that way?
So no real difference other than maybe time.
Prior to SECURE Act, there was a very big difference.
There was a big difference. Yeah.
Okay. And so that's one of the things we advise the clients and advisors on, is if your documents were drafted pre-SECURE Act, look at them again and look at your plan again.
Because you may want to change the beneficiaries.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
And the second point I'd make, there is the option of accumulation trust. Sometimes people have extreme spendthrift situations where they do want those IRA assets to go and be distributed along the same terms as the rest of the trust. That is a tax disadvantage oftentimes, because that undistributed income that's retained within the trust is going to be taxed at the trust and estate's tax rate as opposed to the individual's tax rate.
Let's talk about homes in the state of Florida. Again, estate attorneys half the time recommend that you put your primary residence in the name of your trust. Specifically, if you have beneficiaries, you know that directly these are going to go to on a simple estate. And some say you have homestead exemption, it's probate free. You don't have to worry about that. That will dictate that. Do you have any specific advice on when it comes to why one would suggest naming it in the name of the trust, and why would another attorney say just leave it in your own name?
Well, oftentimes it comes down to a lot. I think a lot of the opinions based on the tenants by the entirety's protection, and also how the estate plan structured. Is it a mutual trust, or is it a joint revocable, or are there separate revocable trusts? Oftentimes, if there's separate revocable trust, you might see the attorney want to leave it in tenants by the entirety's titling, and then
just to protect it.
And then upon the death of the first spouse, you would add it into the trust of the second spouse. That's a really common situation there.
That seems the most appropriate action would be to keep it in joints with entirety, right? I mean, why? I mean, I guess your house is already protected, or is it even more protected inside of that joints with entirety?
It's tenants by the entirety is going to be full protection in the state of Florida. Now, you do have the ability to preserve homestead through the inclusion of clauses in the trust, but I will say that I generally see most people in a married couple situation leave it tenants by the entireties until the first spouse passes, if they're doing separate trusts. But I mean, like I said, everybody's situation's different, and there can be something that causes just a client wish even.
Now, there's a lot of states that do not have joint tenants with entirety. In those situations, a trust might be better.
It could be. Yeah. Every state law is different, and state law controls property rights.
Got it.
So that's a very important point, that every state is different. One of the benefits, though, especially if you have like a secondary property, if you have a property in a state other than your state you're domiciled in, you're not going to require ancillary probate if that property is held within the revocable trust. If it's held in your individual name, you're going to have to open up ancillary probate in that state to dispose of that asset properly.
Got it.
Yeah.
So I want to end on this. Is there any advice? Now, you went into the business, dad was in the business, you got in the business, you kind of figured, hey, I'm not a rainmaker per se. That's just not what I enjoy doing, and I'm not necessarily great at that. But you love the business and you're doing a phenomenal job where you're at. Your name is passed around through our industry here. You're well known, you're well liked, and you're doing great. Would there be any advice you'd give to people that are maybe considering becoming advisors, or it's their first or second year in the business, that there might be other avenues in the business that you may want to consider? And then you can always come back to being an advisor later, as we talked about.
Yeah, I think it really comes down to what's the right fit for you. Now, I mean, I wouldn't say to give up after you've been an advisor for a year. I spent 2.5 years doing it, and I really enjoyed helping clients, but it was just a personal feeling from that standpoint.
Yeah.
But I would say don't, limit yourself to that. I know other people that are internal that were advisors that are thriving now internally, whether it's a planning role or something along those lines. They didn't want to necessarily be a client facing person. So I do still get to face clients, and I like that part of the business, but other people don't. Some people might just say, hey, I just want to be a PM. And those opportunities are definitely available internally. So it really just makes sense to take a look at and evaluate what you want to do and actually enjoy on that day-to-day basis.
That's a great piece of advice. And for anybody that wants to get a hold of you, Chris, by the way, are you able to take, let's just say, an RIA as an example, and I have a client that is interested in a corporate trustee, are you allowed to take that kind of business?
So that's kind of evolving right now.
Okay.
But as of right now, you have to be affiliated with Raymond James.
Okay. But that might evolve in the future.
Might evolve in the future.
Either way, if somebody has questions or wants to contact you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Cell phone. Yeah. 561-418-2494.
Awesome. And are you on LinkedIn as well?
I'm on LinkedIn as well.
So we can find you and message you there as well.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Excellent. Chris, thank you so much. Pleasure having you on. Learned a lot today and a lot of interesting facts. If any advisor has any questions, please contact Chris directly. Other than that, hope everybody enjoyed today's podcast and have a great day. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.